Hello and welcome to a new episode of Interpreting India. From geopolitical complexities to economic uncertainties, India faces critical challenges in its quest for a more prominent role on the world stage. This season, we at Carnegie India continue to bring voices from India and around the world to examine the role of technology, the economy, and international security in shaping India's future. India, being a continent-sized country, contains multitudes within it. The per capita GSDP of the richest large state in India is more than 5 times that of the poorest large state. There are regions of India that are at par with upper middle income countries, and then there are regions that are as impoverished as sub-Saharan African countries. While development is a national process, we also need to pay close attention to what is happening in the regions, what is enabling and what is impeding development in the region. A new book called Regional Economic Diversity, Lessons from an Emergent India, does exactly this. Written by Dr. Poonima Dore and Dr. Krishnan Narayanan, this book takes a deep dive into the dynamics of regional development in India. I'm your host, Suyash Rai, and for this episode of Interpreting India, Dr. Poonima Dore joins me to discuss her co-authored book. Dr. Dore is an economist and business leader with deep experience in digital transformation, corporate finance, and development finance. She is currently a visiting professor at Accelerite Jamshedpur. She has previously worked as Director of Analytics, Insights and Impact at the Tata Trusts, one of India's largest philanthropic institutions. She has earlier led the structural investments vertical at Tata Capital Limited, where she anchored investments in automotive, pharma, technology, insurance and other sectors. Poonima ji, welcome to Interpreting India.
Thank you so much. Glad to be here.
I really enjoyed reading your book and I learned a lot from it. But let me start with a broad question about the motivation to work on a book like this. For you, when you can only speak for yourself, not for your co-author. But tell me a little bit about your professional background, your interests, and how did you come to the point when you decided to write this book?
So I had not planned on, you know, becoming an author or something like that. It, I think, happened along the way. And I think I have to credit travel for a lot of this. So when I initially joined work with the Tata Group, I was advising companies and business leaders on which kind of financial products would work for them. So I was leading a vertical called Structured Investments, which meant I was traveling a lot to companies and their sites where they were planning on growth, on their next acquisition. And my job as the national product manager was to look at, you know, how do you structure the funding? What, how will it be an acquisition? Which product will work best for them? And in that journey of travel and meeting some of these CEOs, CXOs, I would come across their choices of, you know, whether it was a labor-intensive growth model that they were looking at, whether it was about being, you know, getting the best capital equipment from abroad and building their businesses on the back of that. And as a student of development economics, these questions would be on my mind that, you know, what does this mean for the local economy? How is it going to generate employment? Is this, you know, model going to be a lasting one? And does it actually, is it actually going to give the kind of revenue to the company that they're planning on? So a lot of these side questions would come on my mind and I would be traveling a lot. So I think I had the benefit of being in many parts of India or looking at some of these sites, whether it was in, you know, Chandigarh, where you had, you know, pharma, IT, production on the FMCG side happening, whether it was Madhya Pradesh, where you have a lot of soya and agri product lines getting developed, or even South India, where, you know, you have a mix of both technology as well as manufacturing. So that was one part of what I was looking at. And at some point, I started working on this question that, you know, can capital do more? Which led me to move to the Tata Trusts, where a lot of the access questions became apparent to me. You know, we were working on livelihoods, on job creation, as well as financial inclusion. And so and here it was travel more to the villages, to very remote areas, marginalized groups, and looking at, you know, what access to health, education, etc. means here. So somewhere I started thinking about these questions a little deeper. I wanted to, you know, solidify what I was seeing on practice and trying to solve for on the ground with an academic base. And that's when the PhD happened. So in my case, the PhD happened a little later in life to supplement what, you know, I was seeing in practice. And that those questions became the ones around the regional economy that I was reading, writing about, trying to understand what data sets exist, and also facing the abysmal lack of information on many parameters we want to, you know, go deep into. So, and in that journey of putting together this, I think I was presenting at a few conferences. My co-author, Professor Narayanan, has been my guide. And some of the people I would keep meeting at these, you know, on these journeys would tell me that, you know, not enough has been written about this, or you're onto something which should, you know, get developed further. And that is when Suyaj, I thought that one can, of course, go the route of, you know, more papers and journals and look at how you want to put out this information there. But since I'm on the practice side too, I realized that there are a lot of people like me in business, in government, in policy, who are trying to solve for some of these questions. And so a book seemed to be a good way to, you know, further that conversation, meet people who may have, you know, similar questions. So that's how the book happened. So that it was, I think, 2018-19 when I started converting this body of information that I had into a book form. And I also realized how much work it takes to convert, you know, information that you have into what would be readable material for an audience. So structuring time, carving out moments from early morning, late nights. I had a young daughter also at that time. So navigating this and keeping this project on slow burn alongside life, I think, has been the journey of this book.
Yeah, so I'm glad that you continued with that journey and came out with this book. And I mean, pull through this process for a few years and bring out a book is quite a challenge. But also, in terms of thinking about the regions, I think you make an important set of methodological interventions. We'll go through them systematically during the course of this conversation. But if I may ask, since you've kind of brought a focus to the region as a unit of analysis, you've said we need to think about place, proximity, access, is this the spatial dimension in a different way, not at the state level, necessarily not at district level, but at regional level, and also bring a temporal dimension to it. But talk a little bit about the methodological choices you made while writing this book in terms of what are the kind of variables you picked, how did you come to the data sources, what difficulties you faced in doing so, you know, because this level of focus on regional development has not been there for a while now. Although ideologically, we have often talked about regional development in India, since the independence itself, but this kind of analytical, rigorous kind of approach to it that you brought to the book has not been seen in a long time. So how did you make those choices? What are the challenges you face also?
Thank you, Suyash, for actually categorizing it as a methodological intervention, because I think in hindsight, when one looks at the process, that's what I think one had to come to. Because in what I realized while looking at the canvas of India and trying to, you know, make sense of what is happening at a subunit level, and I'll, you know, go on to talk about how we looked at regions. It is on one part, we are seeing so much variation, which, you know, we do end up talking about at a state level. As a country, we talk about growth, we talk about state level changes. But clearly, I think through travel and through what the data tells us, there are so many sub-state level variations. So the challenge and the question in my mind was, how does one capture this? You know, A, how does one analyze it? How does one capture it? And B, how does one then make sense of it for a, you know, larger group? And in that journey, I think I went through, so the literature showed me that there were a lot of state level studies that have happened. There are people who have looked at convergence and divergence and, you know, all of that, a lot of that at the state level. However, we have not had a lens on what is happening at a sub-state. So looking at regions at a sub-state level, I think, was one of the clear things. I would have actually liked to go even more local. But the challenge I faced there were, are there contiguous data sets with, you know, sufficient level of granularity, which are able to tell us what's happening? So if I want to see, okay, within, say, Orissa, you know, which pockets of Odisha seem to be growing, which pockets seem to be having issues. How does one make sense of the data? And I found many location-specific studies. So people who have done, say, a deep dive into metropolitan, you know, Maharashtra or Mumbai, or there are these studies of 3-4 metropolitan areas. Vivek Debroy's work on district level analysis was something I went to, you know, and was one of the early markers which helped me conceptualize how I wanted to look at it. But I did find that, A, we didn't have enough data sets at the district level for some of the questions I was looking at. Also, I figured that the district and the city, if we look at India, we have 600 plus districts. If we want to make decisions from a policy level, or if we want to have recommendations which people can act on, it's a very large number. At the same time, states are good. It's a good, you know, 28 states plus so many union territories, and you have, that's a good number to deal with. The states themselves are so huge that there is too much variation within. So in this process, I looked at NSS data, I looked at ASI, which then looks at it from the industry standpoint, you know, which lens would be a good lens to look at it. Now, I found that regions have been looked at, one, from the point of view of homogeneity. There are three ways in which, you know, people in the literature have looked at regions. One is homogeneity. Can we classify them based on, you know, geographic proximity? The second is political boundaries. So, you know, constituencies, and that could be another way of, you know, categorizing them. And the third is administrative management. So that's where our block, panchayat, state kind of boundaries come in. And in for the purpose of our analysis, what I figured would make sense was the geographic contiguity, because there are the, in our national sample survey, I came across the methodology that the NSS has used, and I thought it was very intuitive. And a lot of very intelligent people in our statistical commissions over the years have worked to refine this framework. I don't think enough people in India look at the NSS framework or have understood it. But in the course of my journey, having engaged with it enough, I found that the NSS region brings together a set of districts within a state, which are geographically contiguous, which are similar in terms of their agroclimatic zones, and also linguistically, you know, there is similarity of what works there. So that's a very good unit. And so that what that means, an NSS region lens, means that a Maharashtra gets divided into six regions. A UP has 6 or 7 regions, but which are, these blocks are already then, you know, geographically contiguous. There's a science behind defining them. And so pan India, we are able to look at India as a set of 88 NSS regions based on the 2011-12 NSS survey. So I thought that was a very scientific way in which, you know, a publicly managed and collected data set exists in our country. There's a lot of thought that has gone towards it. And one of the cases I would like to make in the course of, you know, also talking about the book or the ideas from it, is for more people to use the NSS markers in their studies, to look at the NSS frame from a public policy standpoint. And I genuinely believe that one thing we should, you know, start doing more as a country is any data that we collect to have the NSS as a marker, the NSS region as a marker, so that tomorrow when we are triangulating data sets, at least at the NSS level, we are able to, you know, build commonality and have a way of, you know, articulating what we mean by growth as well as access.
So if I want to connect your first answer and the second answer, you know, I see some kind of pattern, because you came to it from the business side, right? Like, you were going and visiting these areas and you're seeing this sub-state diversity and certain kind of homogeneity in the region. If you look at the way businesses, large businesses in India are structured, they have regional managers. And those regions are somewhat rationally defined. You know, maybe they're not as, I mean, deeply thought as, say, NSS regions, but there is some rationality to defining what regions are and what the zones are. So I'm glad that you came from that direction of practical business and decisions about how regions are structured, what opportunities exist in different regions. Because states are much more of a political kind of units, right? They may be linguistic kind of grounds and all, but within those states, there is so much variation And then you found this NSS region approach, which seems to have kind of served you well in terms of being able to at least do the analysis on the basis of that. Now, I want to jump to one specific exercise that you did, which is to estimate the regional value added. So this, as you say, is the first time that anybody has tried to rigorously estimate the regional value added and try to do the analysis of divergence, convergence, what are the factors driving the regional value added, what's driving. So if you tell us first about how did you go about doing the estimate of RVA and what are the challenges that kind of came in the way. Then we'll go into the analysis a little bit.
So the first question that one hits is that if we are talking about growth and development, how do we quantify it? And the fact remains that we have at best domestic product defined at a state level. And some districts now have district level GDP estimates. But we don't have, you know, a collective way of measuring output. Now we have some studies which have started looking at city level GDP. But our issue is that at a regional level, we are saying that regions are engines of growth. But we don't have a way to quantify it. And so one of the efforts through this was to arrive at a way to measure, to, you know, to put a peg in the ground, so to say, that, you know, this is how we should be able to, you know, it is an approximation at best, you know, but what, so the method that I tried to look at was UNDP has done certain localization based studies, and Mitra and Maiti had in one of their papers, you know, applied certain weights using workforce participation rate, using workforce productivity, etc., as weights to the to arrive at what could it be at a region level. And some of those parameters are actually captured by the NSS as part of their employment unemployment survey. So in the absence of existing metrics that we had, and so yes, we found this across the board for, you know, when I was trying to measure access to skills or access to finance, you know, identifying what would be the right metric that one can, you know, arrive at has been a process in this journey. It's not been a case that, you know, you have this large data set with well-defined fields, which you are then, you know, making sense of. It has been, and I will be honest, I have been at times been dissuaded from looking at some of these research questions also, that, you know, this data does not exist in India today in that level of granularity, you know, so don't, let's not chase this right now. But I realize as a practitioner that if we are not going to ask or find a way at least to build some of those measurements, the hard questions of access, we're not going to be saying much about them. You know, we will say things about consumption expenditure because we measure that. We will say things about maybe school dropout rates because we have data on that. But for some of these questions, I think it was a bit of a leap of faith also. But what I have been very glad is that a lot of practitioners as well as academics, so somebody like an Arup Mitra, when he comes back and tells me that, you know, this way in which you have measured it, it actually makes intuitive sense and, you know, good that you took that, you know, step to do it. That makes you believe that, yeah, we are on track to, it's a long journey to build some of these metrics and more people will do more research on these lines. More people will hopefully collect more data. But So 3-4 things. One was building what regional value added can look like by taking the broader estimates, applying weights of workforce participation rate, of productivity, these metrics to bring it down to a regional level. So I have the two things that we've had is regional value added as well as regional value added per capita, because the per capita picture then gives a much more real sense of, you know, where the region is on its development trajectory. And also, as a result, have done a top 10, bottom 10 in each of these and triangulated those with, you know, other variables. And the idea behind that was that those that seem to be performing, you know, higher, at least on these parameters. And I would not never say that value added is the only parameter of growth and measure. So therefore, for each of these, the idea was to also capture how diverse is this region in terms of employment. So building a diversification index. And I'd be happy to, you know, chat about that a little more later. but building out what is, you know, access to finance using RBI data. So RBI has a data set that talks about bank branches. So these are, again, business, you realize that where there is a bank branch, where there is an ATM, that choice about where to open the next unit is often driven by these questions of location choice. So which are those data sets that can tell us something about it? You know, where are the plumbers? Where are people who are, you know, trained in certain types of trades? So looking at the NCO data set from that lens, that which trades are in which location. Today, we have that data set. So how can we use it to build a metric?
Now, I want to link this up with the broader conceptual framework of the book. So you have engaged with a couple of broad debates on regional development. One is the issue of specialization versus diversification. So agglomeration economics versus localization economics. The other is the question of divergence versus convergence. And you've tried to study these, I mean, through empirically to understand what's going on as far as regional development in India is concerned. And you've developed an interesting analytical framework where you look at market access, localization economics, inter-industry linkage, as well as urbanization economics, which is agglomeration economics, to look at what is driving agglomeration, right? So now, if you can just give broad brush, because this is a podcast, you know, without going too much into detail about how did you come to these specific kind of factors for driving agglomeration, and how do you, what are the patterns that you saw when you looked at these 88 NSS regions, and what's happening? Because you've done an interesting analysis of the top 10 and the bottom 10, and trying to understand what's driving the growth of agglomeration and diversification in those regions, and what is the, so how well is diversity associated with the regional value added in the top 10 regions, and how do they differ with the bottom 10 regions? So give us some broad brushstroke about the insights that connect your empirical work on the RVA with the conceptual framework on the factors driving regional development. And then we can delve deeper into some of those.
I'll start with unpacking the word agglomeration, because it's a word that I encountered for the first time when I was doing the work. And it's basically trying to explain why does concentration happen? So why do some regions, you know, have more factories? Why do firms and people choose to locate in certain places as opposed to the others? Why is, say, the Kalyan Dombivli area around Bombay so crowded and attracting, you know, different kinds of businesses as opposed to, you know, certain other regions? Why does, why has, and this is our lived experience, how has Gurgaon grown as a city? It started with Maruti's factory, and slowly there were so many other things that came along. The malls started getting built. Today, it's the IT and business hub. In 20 years, we know of this region, which is a lived experience of so many of us. Noida has followed suit, you know. So what explains, so I think the book really is about, and these variables are just ways to understand, why do firms and people choose certain geographies over others? And if this is a pattern, how do we make sense of these patterns? In a growing country like India, it becomes important to understand that, because places which are growing fast can attract more capital. It makes sense for businesses to set up units there, etc. And for regions that are not growing so fast or where access is still to be built, there are two ways to look at it. One is that these are harder to solve markets, but also these are the untapped spaces with untapped potential. So I would look at an interior Chhattisgarh, an interior UP, an interior Bihar, even in fact pockets of Karnataka or Orissa, as places which have not yet achieved their full potential. And what my book or the research says, and this journey, if I had to, you know, share with you, the idea is to understand it from two axes. The first axis, of course, is what is working for us as a country? Is it specialization or diversification? Should, you know, India go the route of a Japan or a Germany where they have chosen specialization as their way of, you know, building competitive advantage. If we look at India's data, we find that diversification in that spectrum, regions that are doing better are likely more diversified in their economic mix. And there, by diversified, I mean that they have at least three or more sectors that are firing. It's not one sector which you are saying, okay, it will be auto or it will be IT. It has at least three or more sectors which are firing for the Indian story to actually show that kind of growth. So that's one very important finding which can have policy implications, that we need to understand that diversification is playing out in a certain way for us. We can treat it as a source of competitive strength and build on it. And if we were to move away from it and try to specialize, maybe we would not be playing to our strengths.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, a few years ago, one state government had decided the strategy of one district, one product. So we'll only grow one product. That's the opposite of what a state at that level of development should be doing, right? Because you need to be open to a diverse set of industries. And then maybe at a different stage of development, you can try to specialize or find some kind of a specialized diversification, as you say in your book. Yeah, please carry on. I didn't want to.
No, absolutely. So I think that something like a one district, one product oversimplifies the situation. It tries to give you a silver bullet that is easy to understand and which you feel you have, okay, now I have a tool, I can plan and go ahead. But the way one would want to, you know, leverage now with these kind of insights, it would be to say, no, let us look at it at an NSS region level, not at a district level. And at a region level, look at which four or five sectors or three or four sectors, but at least look at a multiple which can be our source of competitive advantage, because it does two things. One is they feed off each other. So the literature on diversification in the framework also says that, you know, there are then network effects that kick in, which, you know, we are seeing playing out. And the second thing is, in a very simple way, you are diversifying the portfolio of risk. Tomorrow, if there is one sector which is not doing so well or where there are issues around it, you have the others to buffer it and it is able to, you know, keep growth balanced. So for more than one reason, it seems to make sense. And when one of the things we tried to do was actually plot that, you know, over as output is increasing, you know, where do we lie on this continuum of diversification? And it very interestingly takes the form of an inverted U. So it is definitely beneficial, but beyond a point, there are returns which will decrease. And so that sweet spot in the, you know, I actually tried to calculate that sweet spot. It's actually a set of three or four sectors, which in the Indian context, we should be able to. So I would definitely make for a case for, you know, to identify their source of specialized diversification and then chase those very seriously and consciously for a set of years, build those enabling conditions. Help the market players to actually, you know, invest more, make it worth their while to build businesses in those areas. And actually, you know, I would say re-engineer India's entrepreneurial spirit, which we are so high on right now, in a way that intuitively uses the data and builds on that.
I remember reading a couple of years back this book on China's development by Liu Yunyun Ang, who's a very pioneering kind of political economy researcher based in the US. And she also found this pattern in China's regional development, that in early stages of development, when they started off the cycle in the 80s, basically late 70s, 80s, they were very, all-encompassing, that they didn't care. They invest in whatever sector, because we don't know what sectors would be, I mean, you'd be competitive in. And as states developed and became richer, they started specializing more and use what you call a kind of a U, inverted U pattern. It's something similar to the Chinese regional development experience as well. So you see the coastal regions there are specializing much more. Now they are much more trying to develop clusters of sectors which are actually related to each other, like close concentration in certain electronics manufacturing sectors in some regions. But the poorer regions even there, even today, actually are much more multi-industry kind of a scene you see, where they attract investment in a variety of sectors and they're very open to whatever. And then over time, they discover what they're good at. Because in a way, if you are open to a wide range of investment, you also discover by doing what you're good at, what are the kind of trade making that you can do and do successfully in that particular context and learn and get better at doing that. So that really, I mean, resonated with me because it is something that corresponds to regional development experience in many large countries. And this is, of course, the kind of analysis which is most useful in large countries where regions are important units of analysis, right? If you're talking about much smaller countries, city states, these kind of questions don't arise so much. So that was really resonant. Now I want to talk a little bit about so you've got a couple of chapters which are delving deep into the patterns of regional development in India. So because our audience is primarily Indian, they will be able to understand what's going on. So just broadly, what are the patterns of regional development that you saw when you did the analysis of these patterns, especially temporal analysis over time, what's happening across regions in terms of divergence versus convergence? I think you see a lot of divergence, but also a little bit more sense of what are the different three or four key patterns you see in regional development.
One of the key things has been the boom of the construction sector. And I think there methodologically also we pulled out construction as a separate. So instead of the traditional agri, manufacturing and services, construction sometimes gets considered as part of agri or part of manufacturing or services. But I think the observed reality was that there's a lot happening in construction and so saw it valuable to pull it out. And there, definitely the amount of employment in construction, both in urban and rural, but more so rural construction, is huge. And that also tells us that there is a lot of both in, if I were to say construction does mean real estate, which could be residential construction, but also business-related construction means that there are more business activity happening in those areas. It could be by way of roads, it could be by way of hotels, and some of that has been, part of it has been because of the telecom revolution also, which the country has been seeing. And so that has been a very important pattern that construction is going up, but also in many cases, rural construction, the rate of growth is much higher than in urban areas, which also means that some of the migration happening in construction, because that's a sector where we see a lot of migrant labor, is sometimes also rural to rural and not only rural to urban. It lends itself to one more factor, Suyash, which is that the way we have been defining our urban and rural areas, I think now when the next census happens, we will find that a lot more regions which were classified as rural would have actually become urban because so much dense construction has happened in these areas, and the nature of work. So the 2-3 levers by which we define urbanization itself, I think that those numbers and figures we would see, going up a fair bit. And those are a couple of things. Yeah. The third an important finding is this, that while at a state level, we are seeing variations happen, right? We know that diversification is increasing. Regional value added, of course, has increased a lot in our country in this time period. But the state, the variations at the state, I would say they mask the variations at the regional level. The pattern we see at a state level, the regional variations are much more, So if one looks at, for example, southern Gujarat, suddenly there's a lot of growth that has happened there. But if we look at Gujarat as a whole, but we don't look at southern Gujarat in isolation, that story does not come out. So one of the things that we tried to do here was to look at the ranking at a regional level also. And many regions which were not part of the top 10 regions in the previous, time period around 2004-05, but by 11, 12, 13, these regions have really shot up. So the second thing I would like to highlight is that we need to be cognizant that our state level story and our regional level story are very different from each other. And so if we really want to plan and invest For example, so going back to your sales team analogy, the way a regional unit needs to plan for its sales in, say, FMCG or telecom or banking, what is happening at the regional level is going to determine a lot of the forward demand now. Because I would think we have kind of exhausted our, not exhausted, but we are kind of reaching the peak of what our cities are going to be able to, you know, deliver in terms of fresh business. But a lot of the fresh business is going to come from the interiors. And so if we are not keeping our eye out for what's happening at a regional level, we may miss some opportunities or we may overinvest in some places where, you know, we followed a one-size-fits-all approach. So I think strategy heads as well as government policy planners have to look very finely at the regional narrative going forward.
One of the things that struck me is your statement that it's not necessarily the million plus cities that are going to drive the future kind of growth and diversification of the regional economies. Well, why do you say that? Like, what is the underlying analytical insight there?
In looking at the data across growth, so I've done a fair amount of work with Smart Cities mission and all of that, and I'm definitely very passionate about India's big cities story. Having lived myself in, you know, many of these, we live with their pulls and pressures, but we always choose to take the big jobs there. However, when one looks at the data, one of the, so we put a condition that is the growth that we are seeing. What does it have to do with the presence of a million plus city in that region? Now, ideally, if I put a dummy for that, it can tell me that, yes, the presence of a million plus city is actually contributing to, you know, high growth or is correlated in some way. But we find that many of the regions which have shown remarkable progress do not have a million plus city. So that then means that's not telling us that the million plus city is not relevant anymore. That's not what it's saying. But there is then a story of these smaller cities, these smaller hubs, which are contributing to growth, but which are not in that million plus classification. So my takeaway, or you know, the way we can interpret that is really that there are these smaller hubs, which could be the tier two, tier three cities. It could be district level headquarters where, you know, there is a lot of economic activity which is now happening there. And so we need to find ways to plan for them better. We need to harness the energy, because I see this as entrepreneurial energy that, you know, we can tap into, where we need to make sure that, you know, access to finance is provided, that, you know, the digital infrastructure is taking care of these regions and is actually able to build on what they have to offer. And thirdly, preparing some of these smaller cities for the influx of people that is going to happen. So a lot of the, I see a lot of these district level towns, as well as the medium tier two, tier three, take an Indore, Indore and Bhopal, sorry, they would still be under the million plus category. But if you went one level further, there are a lot of these cities where growth is happening, where there is this, you know, business development which is happening, or there is a lot of consumption expenditure happening there now. So from whichever way you cut it, there is this story which an Amrit or something, some of those programs are being able to, you know, do some level of justice to. Or, you know, an aspirational districts program is able to tap into some part of it. But I think very consciously, we need to look at some of these hubs and see what will it take to unlock value. Where do we, how do we want to, you know, make it easier to do business in some of these locations?
Moving on to chapter 8 of your book, which is on cluster, regional clusters. So you've done an interesting cluster analysis to basically identify homogeneous clusters and try to kind of create a typology. So can you tell us a little bit about it? How did you go about making this these clusters, identifying these clusters, and what are the different types of clusters that you identified?
So this was one of the most interesting exercises that, you know, one did as part of this, which was that, okay, now we have, you know, now I've got a fair amount of information across you know, different parameters. Is there a way to classify these regions, or is there a similarity across different regions? So, okay, we are saying there are 88 NSS regions in, you know, 1 year, and there's some 75 NSS regions in another year. But is there a way to, are some regions more similar to each other? Are there any things common? Do they have something to learn from each other? That was the underlying, you know, question. So I ran a cluster analysis with this data and with across. So what parameters did we look at? One is, of course, value added diversification, the index that has been constructed. Looked at the level of urbanization in each of these regions. What is the percentage share of population that is urban? How close is it? Close to a coastal? Is it close to the coast? Does it share, you know, a coastal boundary? Is that saying something about that region? So three vectors that I would say access to. One is economic structure. So parameters of economic structure, which are size, population density, you know, regional value added, but also parameters of access. And here I looked at access to finance. What is the percentage of highly skilled workforce in this region? If we look at it as per, yeah, level 4 plus skills, what is the percentage of that kind of workforce? Second is, you know, access to skills, access to finance. What is the level, the number of bank accounts, new bank accounts that are getting opened, the number of bank branches that exist in that region? Because presence of these things are ways to know that, yes, there is, you won't have a bank branch in a region that is not having enough number of deposit accounts or, you know, business activity happening there. So looking at that. Third is level of urbanization. So percentage urban share, you know, how diverse is the local economy? Also workforce participation rate. So looking at a number of these presence of million plus, so looking at all of these together to arrive at, are there similarities across these regions? And so some of these regions which are, so if I were to, you know, look at which were the classifications that emerged, then I think one also had to name them. You know, if you have, okay, these 5-6 regions that are coming together. So intuitively, the metropolitan regions came together. So Delhi and Bombay, Delhi, Chandigarh form part of one cluster. And we have not done anything artificially here. These are regions that are naturally gravitating to each other, you know. Then a cluster 2, which has a number of the union territories. So Pondicherry, parts of Bangalore, which is the Karnataka, the region of Karnataka that includes a Bangalore, that includes Chennai. So some of the metros as well as some of the union territories come together in cluster B, which I have called a diversified cluster because it has a mix of, you know, both economic activity as well as its flavor in terms of population is quite diversified.
First one is growth hubs. This is the diversified.
Yes. Then the third is moderate, where on pretty much on all of the parameters, they are somewhere middling. That includes Jammu and Kashmir, you know, some parts of Punjab, some parts of Assam, Tripura, you know. And then we have aspirational. So the cluster D, which is aspirational, actually is one where some of the parameters, there is growth happening, but there are also some of the parameters which are where they're not performing very well. So access to skills could be a problem, or access to finance could be a problem. But they are the ones that have probably shown the maximum change in that time period, or, you know, where we are feeling optimistic that something can happen in these regions. There's a story there. Then we have cluster E, which is agrarian, which is largely agricultural in its both, whether it is workforce or it is its own contribution to value added, etc. But one interesting thing here, Suyash, is that in the two time periods, there is a fresh cluster that gets formed in 2011-12. And I'm calling it acute because it is even more stark. The differences in it comes out as a fresh cluster in the next second time period. Now, if we were to believe that our growth story is uniform and everybody is growing, then, you know, the separation of a cluster would not necessarily happen. the fact that, you know, a cluster is coming out separately, it means that it is having some defining characteristics of its own, where on some parameters it's not doing so well. And so that's why we've called it acute, because it probably means that there is some special care that is needed. Some parts of Chhattisgarh are, you know, so central Chhattisgarh becomes part of the agrarian cluster, but northern and southern Chhattisgarh are behaving differently. So even for a new state like Chhattisgarh, it means we need to have a slightly stronger, you know, lens on what are we going to do. And we know that the northern and southern parts are more tribal in nature. They are high on forestation. They have been historically, you know, had Maoist related setbacks. So what is it that needs to happen more in, you know, these regions if we need to create better access? There are also areas where interest groups have felt that not enough is being done to create more access. So there is then a pressing need for us from a policy and from an industry point of view. So industry may say, oh, we are going to Chhattisgarh. We have set up a unit at Raipur. But that is central. That is not looking at north and south.
In fact, two of the these regions are in Maharashtra and Karnataka, which otherwise are very rich states. Inland central Maharashtra and inland eastern Karnataka, you know, which are in the acute category here, which shows how much, I mean, difference exists within these states. Because part of the states are actually in the first two or three, you know, clusters, and some parts are in the acute cluster.
So that is exactly the point of the book, Suyash. I'm so glad that you picked that up. That's really the case, that if even in our so-called well-to-do states, there are certain pockets which are, you know, forming part of an acute cluster, these are our best performing states by any stretch. These are where we also take, you know, when big stakeholders come to visit India, we take them to Maharashtra, we take them to Karnataka, we want to show them how India is doing. But in these states itself, if we have these acute pockets, it really makes the case for a regional lens when we are thinking policy, when we are thinking design, when we are planning our own, you know, both from a business as well as a government point of view. How will we unlock value? It. I think you've actually hit the nail on the head. That is the real point of the book, that why do we need to go regional or why do we need to go granular? It's because of these variations.
So now from this, I want to segue into a couple of questions on, I mean, policy implications, basically. So one of the issues I want to bring up is basically going from what we just discussed, the sub-state variation. Now, the way our state is structured, there is, of course, administrative coherence at national level, state level, district level, block level, and village level. Regions don't have any administrative kind of identity of their own, you know. Cephalologists study regions for electoral purposes. Firms assign regions for bringing coherence to their organizational structure. But our administration doesn't work in that way. So one of the things I wanted to ask you is there any need to reorganize governance structure in India a little bit to bring a little bit more focus to the regions? You know, what would be the implications? It's an open-ended question. So if you can just reflect on that a little bit.
Yeah. I think I will answer it in two parts. I think, give you one bold, ambitious answer and one pragmatic, realist answer. And the bold, ambitious answer to this, I think, would be to have a very focused. So with some of the people on the policy side, we've been talking about, you know, would it make sense to have a Department of Regional Growth, which actually looked at regional growth, regional access, drove some of this across, or, you know, have something within MORD or within the urban missions, or classify rurban, since rurban is an existing mission, have work within that, work streams within that, which make it possible for these regions to, you know, talk to each other. I think that even within groups like FICCI, ASSOCHAM, where CII, which are industry bodies, they do have regional units which have, you know, which bring together stakeholders, etc. I think getting greater thought on looking at the NSS cuts as well would be a useful way to do it. But I think somebody centrally needs to anchor that. So if either one of the industry bodies takes it up alongside someone within government, because I think we have not very intuitively worked on what are our competitive advantage points across regions in India. That problem statement, is a very important problem statement for us. For example, we want to solve for semiconductor, but we are asking everybody to do it. You know, if we were to in a very, and somebody needs to put in that time and effort to do it. So that can either be a department or that can be a sub plan of an existing body. But I think that's an area of very serious work. And a connected leg with that needs to be with MOSPI, where all the data comes in together. Today, MOSPI is the central, repository of information. But a lot of data sets still don't talk to each other. So I have had the opportunity in my role at the trusts and even otherwise to work with MOSPI, to work with the Smart Cities Mission, etc. I think there is a lot of bureaucratic interest and will to get some of these done. If it was possible to have a central mandate, or a program which brought some of this together along with investment, I think it would, make for a solid case. The second answer to this, which is the programmatic, so this needs people to move, capital to come together, an administrative structure which works closely. And we also know that in India, between the central and federal structure itself, there is a lot of, give and take and things to work through. I would think that leveraging the pragmatic answer to this would be that leveraging programs like the Aspirational Districts Program or like Smart Cities or Amrit Mission. Now, these are existing missions or existing programs which are there. Now, when I was working closely with the Aspirational Districts Program, one of the things that we tried to do was build granular data sets with district collectors, with the central stakeholders. And I think Niti Aayog had an interesting way of having the similar performing districts talk to each other. And that, I think, is a very nice extension of what, I would recommend here, where similar districts or similar regions have to be able to learn from each other. We have conversations often within the state, but this kind of a national platform, and I have seen that in action at the Aspirational Districts Program. I have seen that in action at the Smart Cities Mission. You may have, there are many critiques of these programs also, but I would think that structurally, the fact that, those which sit within different hierarchical boundaries get an opportunity to cross-pollinate through these programs. That is the kind of flavor I would like to bring to this regional narrative. So if different NSS regions had a space which are similar, and we could even use this, the classification that we have already arrived at, say the moderate regions had an opportunity to meet together, trade best practices, figure out what's not working for you, what's working for me. Similarly, for the acute regions, to actually have a expert group go and spend time there to see what will it take to, build at least two more areas of competitive advantage and not look at these as top-down prescriptive, modes, but to actually engage with some of the business leaders in those areas, which are some of those areas of competitive advantage which can work in this region. What do you have raw materials for? And try to bring that together. So cross-pollination and targeted interventions which could be within the remit, of the existing administrative structures would be my second bid. I think our country is probably ready more for the second than for the first. The second could be a route to the first, where you do it, you test it, you're able to show that this kind of a thinking works. Because I think taking states and the center along is a better long-term solution. And having also members of the IAS come in quite actively into this. So a third solution which you didn't ask for would be to get regional thinking more actively into LBS and places like that. So that, at the prep stage itself, you're going and prepped up to think about your regions and plan for them.
So when you said one ambitious and one more pragmatic, I think both of the answers are more pragmatic only. But let me then throw a more ambitious kind of idea. It's not a new idea, but your book made me think about it again afresh. Is the simple idea that why don't we have 100 states, like regions or 88 states? So each region, the contiguous, because US is 50 states, right? Like it is, the population is less than a third of our population. Would that help in any way? I mean, it's just an idea for you to consider, because one of the things we see is that within states, certain regions are marching ahead and other state regions are not able to catch up. And there may be good reasons for that. But would creating administrative coherence at the regional level, we are saying the region itself is, has a different kind of political identity, and then it can invest in itself, it can have its own strategies for economic policies and all of that comes with it. It's not beholden to the state level politics so much.
Interesting idea. I would think that activating, unlocking economic activity at a regional level need not need an added administrative layer. By which I would say that I think administration itself absorbs a lot of energy, cost, etc. at the state with its machinery. And sometimes the machinery itself can create more layers than, you know, unlocking and making things easier. I would argue for if within states at the NSS region level, if we could find a way to improve the ease of doing business at a regional level, you know, that would be a better way where we are not creating more administrative, otherwise one more high court, one more, you know, election, one more, instead of adding those layers, if we were to create a mechanism to make economic activity as well as unlocking access. So not all activity is economic. So some things like skill universities or, you know, what are, how do, say, fintech companies go into regions better. So I would look at it as a mix of both. Some things administration can do, but a lot of things the private sector also needs to step forward and get into. So making it easier for this nexus and unlocking some of that value at a regional level, to my mind, so a focused, say, a focused central program that looks at unlocking regional value with hubs within the state could be another way to, you know, do this architecture, but not necessarily adding that added administrative layer. Oh, and
thank you, Poornimaji, for taking the time to talk to us about this book. It was a real pleasure speaking with you. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Suyash. Very glad to be here with your insightful questions.
We'll be back in 2 weeks with a new episode. To make sure you don't miss it, be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, wherever you get your podcasts from. To learn more about our research and team, you can visit us at carnegieindia.org. You can also find us on social media on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Thank you for listening. See you next time.